components in manufacturing and input costs. So the way the hearings have been configured is to ensure that we get the benefit of that. And what we certainly would like to hear from the manufacturing folks, among others, what are the challenges they are facing so that we can attempt to see that they are addressed. So having lost virtually half an hour, we like to move very quickly just in the apologies here. What apologies do we have? We have, I don't see any apologies. Someone may have for me, Mr. Kobasa, the Honorable Salah. All right. I am aware that our whip, the Honourable Khadebe, is in strategy and will be joining us. And Honourable Mabasa is just across there. I've been made aware by the Honourable McIntosh here now that he's sitting also in a very critical committee of home affairs, which require his presence from time to time. But I hope that the rest of us will be here to get this input. Honourable Khadebe, we started at the break because we had no power. I don't know if that raises the significance of electricity or technology, but can we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda, please? Thank you, Honourable Kobasa, seconded by Honourable James. On that note, at half past, can we start with the input by the manufacturing circle?
Chairperson, thank you very much. I would like to introduce our delegation here today. My name is Kunran Sedman. I'm the business director of the manufacturing circle. I have been through great challenges to find real-life manufacturers to bring to the meeting today that I found, and they sit here next to me. I've got the Oramachiri and Kabela from Ultron, and then from Impact, another manufacturing circle member is the CEO Bruce Strong, and Mosumi Motori next to him.
I should have recognized, I just didn't see him towards the front, but the acting DDG of this area, Mr. Garth Strachan, of course, and other members.
And that is very appropriate because although manufacturing is certainly facing unprecedented challenges at the moment, it is always great for us to acknowledge that in DPI and particularly in Garth Strachan's new department, we have got the support that the manufacturing hasn't known since 1994, and we would like to acknowledge that. It's always great to just come here and make some constructive proposals because in the not too distant past, cut my teeth observing committees like these in Parliament. With that, I think we should start our presentation. I want to say that the manufacturing circle came into being a bit like a religious character. Nobody's quite sure when it was born, but it's around about 2007, 2008. In response to the DISA negotiations at the time, where the need for a specific voice that would speak on behalf of manufacturing was recognized. It was immaculate. We are still immaculate. We just ray, but we vibrant and strong we climb. We've got around about our organization in particular has got around about 40,000 members at the moment, representing 200,000 plus jobs, but our sector in total represents about 1.7 million jobs. So we hope that you will find our presentation informative. We took the very specific brief that you gave to us and tried to do something about it. If there's something that we haven't covered, it's not an intentional piece of the question, we'll provide the answer. With that, I'd like to give over to Ms. Strong for the presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present. accounts for some 15% of GDP, 1.7 million jobs, approximately, and very importantly, the base load for the generation of electricity and other services that are provided to many people across the country. Without a manufacturing base, I think the cost of providing those services would be substantially more than it is today. Despite the importance of the sector, and I could just add that I'm not going through all the points on the slide. I'll cover some of the key points in the interest of getting through in the time allotted. But despite the importance of manufacturing to the economy, there's no doubt that we face some very significant challenges in South Africa at this time. Over the past 5 years or so, some 300,000 jobs have been lost in manufacturing in South Africa. We've seen over 400,000 small businesses shut their doors for various reasons over the past years. We've seen electricity costs go up in excess of 170% over the past 5 years, and very significantly, we've seen the electricity costs in competitive countries and some of those in the BRICS countries going down by some 30-odd%. So our relative competitive position has deteriorated substantially. And in addition to that, we've got several instances. We've got several instances of trade practices where we are certainly unfairly treated. This isn't about protection; it's only about fair trade. And there are several instances where the trade that we experience is certainly not fair in global terms. The manufacturing circle has given great consideration over the past period to what it would be that would position South African manufacturing competitively globally. And we've set out for ourselves four goals that we think would be worth looking at and exploring, and we'd be happy to share those with you in more detail over the coming months as they are more detailed, articulated in more detail. But the first goal is to see South Africa offering a business environment that attracts investment in manufacturing. The second goal would see South Africa as a gateway manufacturing destination for exports to sub-Saharan Africa and other key markets, it must be said, and that South African manufacturers will compete domestically on an equal footing with imports. The third goal would see South Africa being a competitive beneficiator of its own resources. And fourthly, we'd see South African manufactured products being preferred by South Africans and having an excellent reputation around the world. I think that it's incumbent upon us, while we do face many challenges, to look at what we need to do as an industry, but also as a country, to make sure those goals are achieved and we're able to generate the jobs and the prosperity that we all deserve. Despite all of that, there's no doubt, as I mentioned, that manufacturing is in some crisis at the moment in South Africa. The chart before you here shows mining production, manufacturing production, and vehicle sales. And it looks a bit cluttered, but what you can see is that manufacturing has gone nowhere over the last 3 years. And in fact, if you took 2005 as a base, it's not shown on the chart, but I'll mention it. If 2005 is a base where we'd have 100, 2007 and 2008 we're sitting at about 110%, or 10% up on that, and today we are on 104. So we're 6% down on the peak that we achieved just before the recession, the Great Recession started. And we're only 4% up on 2005 in volume terms, which is a significant challenge. But also interesting to note just on that slide is that through some of the public-private partnerships that have been fostered over many years, most notably in vehicle sales, vehicle manufacturing, you'll see that there has been some progress made, and it shows that there is hope in that respect, and we should look to continue in that type of partnership. On the next slide, you'll see that while manufacturers have suffered, imports have continued unabated into South Africa. And that's been at the expense of a number of things, most importantly, jobs, as I mentioned, 300,000 jobs down over the past year. So we've seen imports increasing and exports just moving along on a flat trajectory over that period. And that has had some significant impact on the trade deficit, which it seems is becoming entrenched, as you can see from the slide before you there, where we've seen for the balance of this year, for the year past, we've seen a trade deficit in every single month so far. And that's driven by imports coming from countries specifically like China, as you'll see if we move on, where from the year 2000 to 2011, imports from China have increased tenfold, so 10 times more than what they were in 2000. And while some of those imports are competing on a fair basis, it is fair to say that many of those are on the basis of subsidized industries in Chinese countries and different things that are not exactly considered fair in the current environment. If we look at countries like Brazil, for example, we've got a tariff regime there where you take in one particular product, the duties going into Brazil are around 25%, and the duties of the same products coming into South Africa from Brazil are zero. That's some of the challenges that we face, and has led also to an increase in products from those countries challenging those in the local market on an unfair basis. We've also seen that the Purchasing Managers Index is at a three-year low in September, indicating that there is not a lot of optimism in the near future around the growth in manufacturing. And you'll see that, as I mentioned previously, the employment in the industry is down from 2 million to 1.6 million. And I think it is fair to say and important to mention that there are many manufacturing industries that provide, beyond agriculture, of course, provide the only real means of employment in rural areas. You take industries like forestry and even green energy and things like that. There's no doubt that those industries provide the type of employment and real food employment in rural areas. We've seen small businesses close, 440,000 in the last 5 years, a significant part of the economy and a significant employer across many groups. And many of the challenges are also underpinned by the volatility in exchange rate that you'll see on this slide, which shows that the South African rand is certainly one of the more volatile currencies around the world. And as a manufacturer, I can tell you that it is very difficult to plan your business or forecast and also make informed decisions on investments with that type of volatility, because what your price is today might seem competitive, but the volatility in the rand could soon make you very uncompetitive, even if it's for a short period, and your projects that you've commissioned don't deliver the returns that are expected, thereby also undermining the confidence of your shareholders in your business. So that is a significant problem and challenge for us. And you can see there in terms of the gross reserves, Conrad could talk to that a bit later if you'd like to talk about that. If we look at the next slide, you'll see the cost pushes are significant. And here it is important to note that electricity costs have gone up, you know, since 2002, over 180%. The rand has strengthened versus the dollar since 2002. And our competitor countries, as you'll see in the slide just now, have decreased substantially over that period. So this chart here that is shown in front of you, growth rates of administered prices between 2000 and 2010, will show that the South African slide shows electricity up 172%, whereas Brazil is down 8.5%, China is down 2%, India is down 37%, and Russia is down 16% over the same period. So if you look at that in relative competitive advantage terms, we're at a significant disadvantage. Brazil, as it should be known, has announced that they will be cutting in industrial electricity rates by 28% from 2013, while we are facing 16% increases year on year for the next 5 years. There's no doubt that with all the will in the world and the best brains applied, we're up against significant challenges if we don't do something about this and really attend to the trajectory that we're on as manufacturers. The electricity situation is also exacerbated and made worse by the fact that municipal charges don't necessarily reflect the cost of supplying electricity. We find that across a number of municipalities, electricity charges actually are inflated well beyond the cost of providing that electricity to subsidize possibly other areas of municipal operations. But this situation is certainly one that needs critical and urgent attention if we are to make sure that we remain competitive, or at least return to some competitiveness in our manufacturing sector. And two important points to note here are the direct effects, the last 2 points on this slide, which show the baseline cost structure for local manufacturing just accelerating and inflating well beyond what would make us globally competitive. And then the indirect effects, which would see mining companies reduce output, for example, which has a direct knock-on effect to manufacturing companies who supply those mining companies. That must be said. And I can tell you in there are some cases with some of our members where the costs of electricity provided to some of their factories is now higher than that in Germany where they have similar factories. So that gives you an indication that while it is said in many circles that South African electricity is still cheap, there are a number of industries where electricity is a significantly higher cost than what you could imagine. We've got some specific proposals which we think are required in terms of electricity. There's no doubt that one of the biggest impacts, and I think it's fair to say, I should just mention that we acknowledge that there is a need to reinvest in the electricity capacity within South Africa, and there's a need over time for that cost to be borne through the economy. But the one thing that isn't bearable is the sudden change. You know, manufacturers, like all businesses, are unable to deal with shocks to the system, especially if those shocks to the system are not felt by competitor countries around the world. So the trajectory and the rate of change of these electricity costs, I think, is something that needs to be attended to very urgently. The second thing is to give NERSA the capacity to really interrogate Eskom's price increases and how those arrived at, and also to better sensitize Eskom to the impacts of the electricity cost increases on economic growth and job creation, and how that's going to affect the entire country. And we believe that it is necessary at this point, as you've seen the Brazilians are doing, to give some form of relief to manufacturers if we are to make sure that the current bleeding in terms of jobs and also general prospects is to stop. I'd like to now hand over to my colleague, Conrad Besaidenhout, who will talk more generally about some of the other issues around administered prices and local procurement and other things that we have to propose to this committee.
I think it's very important to note, as you've seen from the slide that illustrated the markups that we see in municipalities on electricity, that obviously there's a severe problem of fiscal nature, where these municipalities find themselves unable to get revenue accruing to them, resulting from their own developmental success. What the municipalities have told them in the past is that either need control over the instrument or the rate at which they charge to get revenue into the municipality. They feel that since the RFC levies have disappeared, they don't have that anymore. There has been some clawback as a result of allocations from the fuel levy and some tax exemptions, but they haven't been able to get that to a degree that they feel that they are able to say that they are compensated fairly. As a result, they have proposed go and study maths and science because manufacturing requires it. If it's not there, they won't go and do it. Manufacturing provides rural infrastructure. There are situations where the downturn, the electricity price increases have lead, for instance, the guys that manufacture or process frozen potato chips have cancelled investments of millions of rand in feed laboratories. So and rural infrastructure, roads that need to be built to loading docks and so on, that are not being completed. And also downstream upgrades in manufacturing plants that are not being done. And then, of course, there's also the fact that manufacturing is a great multiplier in terms of the revenue that accrues to the fiscus as a result of investment, of people getting jobs, of taxes being paid. Therefore, local procurement should be prioritized to the degree that price differentials still make for economic outcomes. There is a case to be made to say that, well, we cannot, for instance, match a particular price from a import coming into South Africa, but there is a differential of, say, 5 to 10% in certain industries, others it will be higher or lower, where it will still make sense to prefer the South African manufactured product above the imported product. And we think that those studies should be conducted and that those determinations should be made. Around local procurement, we think there's the same thing that should be happening in terms of what's happening at the moment. Just to ensure that there's coherent coordination, even implementation to our government, there are departments that are not yet in line with approach. There are municipalities, government entities that are not there yet. We think that tenders that give undue preference factors other than price and quality should be eliminated. Funding and pricing practices play a role in determining how these tenders play out. We need to ensure absolute clarity, wide dissemination, and proper policing of local procurement rules. We support the prioritization of local procurement under the BEE dispensation. And also, of course, under the six or so areas where designation is granted, the finalization of the set of options for that, which we need to see. Partly to assist government in ensuring this quality coherence coordination that we need to see with regards to local procurement, but also to bring the private sector on site. There is a local procurement coordinator signed last year. Private sector has to move as quickly as needed to have to implement it on their side. There's no monitoring and evaluation happening at the moment to say, well, we signed this thing that says there's an aspirational target to meet, but yet we don't even monitor and evaluate at the moment to make sure that we do incremental increases on a year-on-year basis. So we think it opens the door for both the private and the public sector if we have a strong campaign to promote the idea of buying local manufacturing. It's also a proposal on our side to bring that packet of opinion that says that why is it important to have South African manufacturing? Are we a manufacturing country? Well, of course we are a manufacturing country because we manufacture high quality goods here. We've been doing it for a long period of time. And there's no country with a plural economy that has made it to prosperity without manufacturing. It's the only way for us to do it. So therefore we are proposing that there be a strong
questions of chair, will they also be participating in any response of your chief?
Chair, they are here to protect us when you ask physical questions.
Right. We, on the schedule, we haven't really put a question and answer, but if there's anything particularly that we could get this back in writing, you know, if we don't have the time, please raise them. And I'm sure you will note them, right, if we don't have time to respond. Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Jane, Honourable Davey, Honourable Benjamin, Honourable Mawak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strong, Mr. Zedner, for the presentation. I just want to ask a question about ITAC. You spoke about the kind of unfair playing field which incentivized the imports from, or exports from competitive countries, competitor countries. And I wanted to check what your experience has been with applications for countervailing tariffs or that kind of thing, and whether, I mean, you hear a lot of those kind of statements, you would appreciate you hear a lot of those kind of statements, but the fact is that you would have seen you recently lost the case at the WTO because of it. You know, there's got to be very, very solid evidence of that kind of thing. Is there such?
Thank you very much for the presentation. Could you deal specifically with the question of steel and the steel market and the imports and exports of steel with China, and the whole question of how it is that Chinese steel-based imports are as expensive as they are, because the suspicion is that there is some subsidy but nobody's able to check it out. The whole steel market and steel pricing market and manufactured goods when it comes to steel is an issue. I was approached by manufacturers like Cape Gate, for example, and they are feeding the pitch of cheap Chinese imports that's based on the import of our steel to them. See if you can just address that question, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've also joined my colleagues in appreciating the presentation, but I'll start first with the manufacturing sector. That how much reach do they have in the industry itself? Because I appreciate the fact that they promote manufacturing industrialization, which is good. But to find out the key role players like Ikumba, Iron Ore, what did they do? They came up with a study in 2010, where they indicated that rather than beneficiating the steel, it is cheaper for them to export it as it is to Rabat. So how do you interact with such policies? Because I would have expected that as a manufacturing sector, we have supported our call that our minerals must be beneficiated locally. I've also seen in your presentation that the issue of local beneficiation is very important. So how do you interact with such policies? Because they are holding this key mineral. This is very strategic for industrialization, but they don't beneficiate it, they export it as it is. Number two, on the issue of the threat of the imports, as I said, that were from China in particular. You know, in the other countries, they use non-tariff barriers to block out the imports. But I think that if we, in South Africa, we use bodies like the National Regulator of Compulsory Specifications, we'll be able to keep a lot of these imports out. For example, you go to the issue of steel wiring, electrical wiring. A lot of electrical wiring which comes into this country, a lot of it is substandard. If the industry did provide intelligence, timely, take it straight to the police like the NRCS, those things could have been blocked. Once they caught the monoxide, in interacting with the regulatory bodies in South Africa to ensure that we block out those things which are substandard. Because really, steel is steel. Effect. If they are going to bring it at a cheaper price than what we are having, they must have caught them somewhere. Just like the issue of the quality of the steel. Yeah. Number two is the issue of the electricity itself. It's good that you raise that South Africa's electricity has increased by about 131%. How is it that is there are other competitor countries like BRICS countries. Their electricity is going down a year after. What is it that being different from us so that we can improve? Because you, as you are involved in the industry, you must be able to have done some sort of work so that you bring it to us so that we can recommend accordingly. Because they will never compete. If these guys are going to increase their electricity by 28% and then we're increasing on our side, then we're going to be in trouble and we're going to be competitive. Thank you, Chef.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation. I'm very interested in your slide on the demand charge above Eskom Megaflex thing. And I just need to understand it a little bit better. Because it would seem to me there must be a lot of factors why the city power, which I presume to have charges plus 702% above Eskom price, and Tshwane and Peak come next. And there must be other reasons why Tlokwe municipality charges such a small amount above. Presumably it has a lot to do with situation and they work out how they can make money out of this thing and the maintenance and all this kind of stuff. But why don't manufacturers shop around and situate themselves in the places where there's... Why don't they go to municipalities and say to municipalities, we will locate our factory here if you charge us a competitive rate on this matter. Now, I don't want to sound naive about it, but obviously, you know, you have to be where your delivery and the way in which you deliver the product is going to be most cost-effective. But it would seem that there might be an opportunity given the huge range of additional costs on that one. Because electricity is going to be a problem. It is a big problem. It's going to continue to be a problem going into the future. And I can't imagine that we will have any decreases while we try and get our big power stations up and running. The next question I wanted to actually speak to the department about this, because I think you raised very important points about the on the slide talking about your broader proposals you administered. Would there be a problem, department, making sure that the studies that have been done are updated and that they get on the table again? Because it would seem to me that would be a very useful step forward. I think it's a problem that there's been stuff that hasn't been actually seen the light of day, having been done. And it would seem to me that the electricity is the worst problem that you have, because on all those other things, such as incentives, progress. Were you talking about the jobs fund that has been adopted by DBSA? Is that the one that you were talking about? Yeah. Because that looks like it's going to get a bit of a kick injection as well, from what I can gather. So those were my points. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. My first point is concern about the production of the documents, especially when we have drag, if we are to study class and all of them are appearing as black lines up here after, you know, the problem. So in a way they become a waste. And on after thanking the presenters for their inputs, on the part of recycling, what are the opportunities, what are the competitive opportunities that we are having in South Africa? I'm saying this in view of the fact that we have huge companies that are exporting material to be recycled. Is there no way that we can work harder on that so that we do this recycling South Africa? And then the intra-support houses a difference in pricing, because it cannot only be about what is cheaper and what is expensive, but we should also look at what is good for the country. Speaking of what is good for the country, the argument of labor-intensive production versus machinization, to what degree is that appreciated and looked after, secured? Because if we don't, we can also, the president has often spoken of a jobless growth, where we find that if industries do not cautiously say, we don't just want to manufacture, but we want to manufacture where possible using labor absorbing approaches. Thanks, Kobechi.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mabaso. I just want to put a broad statement to you. The issue has already been raised with respect to raw materials and the export thereof. Statements have been made that one of the reasons this is done is because we, South Africa, lack the technological innovation capacity and requisite skills. I mean, is your opinion on this? If so, what are you suggesting do? If that indeed is one of the factors contributing to this, because we want to ensure the beneficiation is done in South Africa, we want to put a stop to this hemorrhaging of our raw materials as they are in the minerals. Now, with respect to how you approach time you have, you're going to be given 5-6 minutes maximum. Therefore, identify what you can do here on the spot so that the rest would come back in the form of a written list. You know, so if you could just identify what would be the most effective way.
Jay, I'll give over to my colleagues to respond, and I'll keep track of what they respond on, and they respond in writing.
Thank you.
But I'll give over to them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will respond on some of the matters which I'm very familiar with, and perhaps some of the others I'll get my colleagues to respond on, or we'll respond in writing. I'll start with the question of ITAC. And the evidence that one has. In our company, we've made several applications to ITAC for various things. All of them have been unsuccessful. And in fact, over the last 10 years, we've seen our duties imposed on products in our sector actually decrease to zero. When the WTO bound rate is actually 5%, and we motivated on the back of some of the issues I mentioned around, for example, Brazil, who is a competitor in this market. If we export there, we face import duties of 25%, so the evidence is there, it's been put forward, and those have been rejected. We are working with ITAC, and in fact, we're meeting with them intimately to understand the underlying reasons, because that's one of the areas where we still have uncertainty. You know, applications are rejected, and there's not a lot of feedback as to why, and we are working extensively now, or more extensively than in the past, to actually understand those reasons and also to motivate in perhaps a way which will make it easier to understand for everybody why that is important. Dealing with the question of demand charging municipalities, the energy intensive user group has done a study on municipalities across the country, and I can't remember all the exact details, but I mean fundamentally I don't think there is any basis for those charges or the allocation of those charges at those levels. And it's probably historical and it's just been carried forward. But that perhaps is a topic for a formal feedback in that regard, because certainly we can't see any justification. We've got factories, one situated in a rural area in Mpumalanga, big factory supplied directly from Eskom, and their cost of electricity is some 20 to 30% cheaper than one of our other factories situated in a municipal area buying from the municipality, which would suggest that there's no benefit to the scale that the municipality has. But we could provide a lot more detail on that, because we do have a fair amount of detail. On the question of recycling and the competitive opportunities, I could just perhaps mention that Our company, Impact Limited, was formerly Mondi Packaging South Africa. We are the biggest recycler in South Africa of anything. We recycle 450,000 tons of paper every year, which is used in products we manufacture in South Africa. So we beneficiate waste paper that is then used for making packaging. There are significant opportunities in recycling in South Africa. We estimate as an industry that the recycling industry employs some 100,000 plus people in various forms, both formally and informally. So it's a massive opportunity, and we think it is a massive opportunity for jobs, for self-employment, and also for beneficiation. There is a challenge with the export of some recycled materials. So you've got steel, for example, is being exported in fair quantities. And also waste paper, you would be surprised to know, is also exported from South Africa because the Chinese are by far the biggest consumers of waste paper, and they don't generate as much as they consume. So we do face competitive pressure there. You know, there are many things to consider there. But there are certainly opportunities in increasing the recycling rates in South Africa across all products. And I think it can benefit the country hugely in terms of jobs and also beneficiation of locally sourced raw materials. I mean, my colleagues would maybe answer some of the other ones.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
On the issue of conservation duties, I'm from Altron, which is in the electronics sector. Our experience has been a difficult one on three fronts. One, the delays generally when one applies for these duties. Let me give an example. We have been interacting with ITEC on the issue of set-top boxes in the DTT project. One, to increase tariffs on imported finished set-top boxes because we feel that the South African manufacturers, and we are one of them, we feel that we have more than enough capacity to be able to supply the whole DTT project through the DOC and as well as the private sector, because at this stage the local manufacturers are actually exporting a lot of the product. It's been a long journey. I saw in the DTI report on ITEP, I saw that it looks like there may be positive feedback on that, but it was a long journey for us, and we had to get a lot of support from the DTI as well as DOC for us to get it. So if something like a project like DTT, which is a country project, it took us a long time to actually get here. I think it's more than 2 years. You can imagine on other projects, on other products, that are not necessarily seen as a national imperative in terms of the national project. So we have had difficulties in other products. That's with delays. The second, the usual response that we get from ITEC is that they can't do it. This is on increasing tariffs on finished goods. They can't do it because it's counter to our WTO agreement, and as the manufacturers, we are not convinced that as South Africa we cannot do it, even if it's temporary, because we see other countries being able to do it. That's countervailing actually. Then the third one is reduction of tariffs. We feel that the South African government was quick to agree to reduction of tariffs. So in our product, which is tariff code 84 and 85, most of our products, I think, are already at no tariffs now. It's really been moving at a fast rate from 10%, in some cases 7%, to zero. This is proving to be very difficult for our industry in terms of competing actually with other countries, other manufacturers.
So when we tender, you see the effect more when now we have to tender for our SOE work. We find that if you include everything, production, the cost of the imported material, finally we find that we are not competitive by, in certain instances, up to like 30%. You try to redesign the product and try to be competitive, but you know you can only say go down to 15%. And so if the tender is awarded on time, which has been the case, especially with something SOE like Eskom, because they've been under pressure with their finances as well, we they're not able to compete. So that's with tariffs. In respect, so I won't answer the issue on skills. In respect to the question around whether we make use of the different regulatory bodies that can help in nurturing our industries other than just countervailing duties, such as the NRCS, it's also proven to be a serious nightmare in interacting with them. We believe, especially in the electronic industry, we believe that there's a lot of less than good quality products, which in our view are not safe, that enter the South African market. And the model that we used to do would be to actually alert the regulator that we know that these products are, you know, on the containers coming to South Africa, and if they could block them, but you have to prove, they want you to prove. So the product enters the market. By the time we are able to do tests and prove that, in fact, the quality, the damage has already been done in the market, and you find that these products are sold at reputable retailers in South Africa, and therefore it's hard for us to actually pass the message to people. Awareness to people that it is a product of inferior quality. But secondly, the regulations, the NRCS regulations, have not been very effective for us in terms of consistency in applying what I think they are meant to do, which is to ensure that the product, and we have raised this with the, I think it's the new commissioner or the acting commissioner, we don't know exactly what he is at this stage, but it's proving to be very difficult. I could spend a lot of time on this one because it's a very difficult one for us. Actually, we believe that our products are of very high quality standards. The local industry in electronics has been around for many, many years, and therefore we also believe that if the technical specifications can be upheld, we could actually be competitive. So this is one of those where I really think that it's important that we put that message across to you in this community. Then on the issue of skills,
I think you need to, you've just got one more minute.
Okay, I'll do that. On the issue of skills, we have done a lot of work as a manufacturer on improving skills in South Africa, both in partnering with schools of excellence in South Africa, as well as in providing experiential training for most of our engineering students. But I think this one probably would need to send a report back to the committee with data. Thank you.
Chair, just to wrap up, I didn't appear in front of you three or four times, I know it's very strict. I'm just going to say the following. I just need to say that we cannot emphasize enough that there is more coordination, coherence, communication, less institutional inertia needed when it comes to the Trade Administration, standards, customs authorities. We are in constant communication with them. We are meeting with ISAC, who I must say we experienced, if not intentionally on their side, as positively oppositional to the growth of manufacturing in South Africa.
and then when you've sent us the written response, which we hope to get very quickly, if there's anything outstanding, we'll come back on that. So at this point, we would like to thank you most sincerely, Mr. Conrad Sadenhout, the executive director of the Manufacturing Circle, also another member, but all of you are members, and we heard from the impact as well that you may be able to contribute to the written responses yourself, because we would appreciate this. So please, if you could just be on standby here with Mr. Herman, is that in order? Thank you very much indeed. We immediately welcome Mr. Roberts, I think it is Dr. Simon Roberts. I'm glad you were present and you were able to hear, although you may have heard this before, but to hear the presentation itself and the input. And we do appreciate you being able to come to us at short notice. Thank you very much indeed. Members, just so that while they're setting up shop here, you know that there'll be a tea break which was scheduled for 10:50, 11:05, but it isn't possible for us to have it until about 10 past. What if I said we'll run that a bit later? Alright. So we immediately move across to yourself, Dr. Roberts. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the committee for the invitation. There's a number of areas in the IPAP which specifically relate to competition or refers to competition policy and actions of the authorities. And I'm going to talk about those. I'm going to give some examples of the work that we're doing and highlight some of the challenges in that regard. And I'm also going to give try to paint a bigger picture as well about how our competition regime is developing and how that relates to industrial policy. But I'm sure I'm going to leave many things out, so there may be questions after. So it'll be a relatively short presentation. That's what I'm going to try and do. So I think, it's very important to say that we see competition and industrial policy as reinforcing. But competition is an active thing. It's about active participation in the market. It's not a passive thing about having a large number of players. Those players, those participants, must be actively competing. And to actively compete, they need to have capabilities. And capabilities requires investment, requires skills, all of the things which are in the realm of industrial policy. So it's not just about having open markets where everybody's on the playing field. It's about building those capabilities to have effective competition. And so there's, I think, a very important link that can be drawn between competition and inclusive growth, because your ability to participate is part of your ability to be included in the economy. This goes to new participants, small and medium enterprises, in that realm. The particular objectives that are linked to competition in the IPAP, and I'll talk about some of these sectors. There's also something in the IPAP about strengthening the implementation of competition policy, about the identification of complementary measures to reinforce and complement the work of the authority, including conditionality to perhaps state support. There's mention of linked to trade policy. I'm not going to go into that in a lot of detail. Having heard the previous presentation, of course, if there's a question, you can go into that. Just to reinforce the point, though, about the linkages between competition policy and industrial policy, I think we are not saying that you need to have lots and lots of small firms in every sector. If you're in the steel industry or you're in a sector where you need to have scale, you need to make long-term investments, then you are going to have a large representation of big firms. Big firms are going to be very important. What we're interested in that case is how do those big firms behave? Do those big firms lock down the sector and just take out maximum profit, or do those big firms invest in an ongoing way in building their capabilities in dynamic competition, producing the next generation of products, marketing their products more effectively, building the capabilities, investing in the training of their employees. So the concept of large firms is very, very important. Those large firms they provided support to large firms. They really didn't provide support to one national champion, so as to have a monopoly. They always played off the large firms against each other. So you see, when you look at the Korean model, and it's important, this is an economy with roughly half the population of South Africa, moving forward in large-scale industries, electronics, etc. You see, you don't see one firm, one LG. You see LG, Daewoo, Samsung, Hyundai. In other words, the support is being given not to a single entity which then becomes the dominant firm. It's been given to a number of firms that are continuing to compete. In other words, you can play them off against each other, even in terms of the support. You give them support, what are they going to give you back? In other words, what commitments are they going to make? I think the history, I'm not talking about the current industrial policy action plan, so I think that makes this very clear, but the earlier history is very much of a single firm that takes up capturing the support for that sector, and then in a sense can hold it ransom, because, you know, they're the only, or they're the main player. The current industrial policy action plan very clearly doesn't say that, it says it wants to maintain rivalry. And I just want to emphasize, this is where we're going to. We should be wary of special pleading by a single firm. We should be developing sectors, developing capabilities in sectors. Those capabilities involve adopting and adapting technology, building capabilities, making long-term investments, rather than just trying to protect short-term profits. So what have we been doing? Well, we move relatively slowly, and I can explain the challenges of our work if members are interested in more detail. And we're working on the main areas we've been working on for the last few years, which is around food products, intermediate industrial products, and construction. So we've had a range of cases in construction, and there's a settlement process that's underway in construction. We've also dealt with a whole set of inputs in the construction sector, such as cement and reinforcing steel. And Afrisam and Lafarge have both admitted the cement cartel conduct and paid penalties as part of that in the last year. We've referred a case in fuel with the major fuel participants around commercial diesel, which, if you think about it, is a major input into trucking, into fishing, into mining, into farming. We've had, as I said, bidreading in construction as opposed to construction products. So we divide construction into the construction projects, the tenders, and the construction products, the reinforcing steel, the cement, the bricks, etc. We've got ongoing cases in food, we've got cases in polypropylene, I'll talk about now, which is in plastic, we've got cases in steel, and here we've got ongoing investigations in supermarkets, forestry, and media. We've also established a separate cartel division to focus specifically on pollution. That's kind of the overview, I suppose. In terms of the case studies, I'm just going to give these as examples. And hopefully that would be interesting and useful. These are also ones that are explicitly mentioned in the IPAP as important areas where competition action is needed to reinforce the IPAP. Polypropylene is a chemical product that is manufactured from propylene gas, which is a byproduct of the fossil fuels business. Why does it matter? Well, it's the key input into making plastic, many plastic products. So this is polypropylene. So is your plastic chair, so is your pencil case, so is your bucket, dustpan and brush, etc. So is your dashboards and cars. So it ranges from very basic products to quite sophisticated products, such as in the automotive sector. It accounts for around about 60% typically of the costs of those firms making the plastic products. So it's the biggest single cost. So it's much more important than, for example, simple wage costs. The Minister of Trade and Industry asked us to investigate the case in this industry. We referred the case in August 2010, and it's a case of excessive pricing against Sasol, who is a monopoly producer of the propylene gas and the major producer, the dominant producer of the polypropylene, and it's going to be heard next year, in 2013. So this is an investigation, I think, which we were asked to start in around about 2007, 2008. This is very important because the IPAP also says, well, there's complementary measures that can be used. So we're a tool that goes, looks back something where it's really in the realm of the industrial policy tools, or the tools where you've got regulated industries, or you've got I'll talk about some of the levers of government, in fact, which we think are very, very important. Because let's consider what we're talking about here. The case about platform charging, the plastics manufacturer, as if that plastics manufacturer was importing it from China. It's a very likely steel case. One of our witnesses is Addis, I think you may know, made plastic buckets, that's one of the most basic things you can think about. And it has led around 600 people down the road here in Cape Town. And they pay for that input as if they were importing it all the way from the Far East. It's a very, very simple case. You can walk into the supermarket and you can look at the plastic buckets, look at the table cases, lunch boxes, and you can say, well, we want people to buy local. We want Walmart to buy local. We want ShopRite to buy local. To buy local, somebody must be there making the product, putting it on the shelf. And the firm making the product has said they're a factual witness for us. They filed their witness case and said that they're getting the product at a much higher price than the person who's making it in the Far East, in China or in Thailand or somewhere. And there's no dispute about the fact that they're getting it cheaper because that's what charged the price at that time as if it was being imported from there. So very, and it was a 10% import duty. So in this context, a 10% import duty raising the import price. In other words, raising the price of Statoil can charge for the product. That's been taken away, at least 10% of the margin has gone. There's still all the transport costs to get it there. So it's better off for the African manufacturer in that context to move some of their manufacturing to China and bring the branded product in here. They will get the product cheaper. It's a very simple story. Whether we can approve the case as a competition case is a very hard issue because there's a whole question about what is a reasonable profit and how you measure economic value. You have thousands of pages of evidence already filed. The facts about the differences in the prices is not in dispute. That will sell the product to China, but charges as if it was being imported to China, from China. So those are real numbers. They export about half of their production. It's a byproduct of liquid fuels. It's a byproduct of their operation. Okay, they have more than the local market can absorb. So they're exporting around half of it. And it's produced from coal, which is subject to mining rights. Standard mining rights says you shouldn't discriminate against local buyers of the mineral and of the product derived from the mineral. That's the standard mining right. I'm talking about the standard one, not necessarily any particular, what the individual mining rights I think are confidential. The standing mining rights has that provision. So we unfortunately are going to carry on with this case, so I must tell you, you must wait for a very long time before we get to the Constitutional Court on this case. We haven't started going through the various appeals processes, etc., as you heard next year at the moment, in terms of the schedule, in the tribunal. And I don't think that I'm the witness for the Constitutional Commission in that case, so it's going to be a large part of my life. Steel, it's a similar story. Big input. Last deal was an agreement with ArcelorMittal when they took over Discord that they would agree a developmental steel price to the DTI and ArcelorMittal South Africa after ArcelorMittal South Africa. Didn't agree on what that meant, and there was a deadlock, and that was never finalized. ArcelorMittal proposed a basket of international prices which included countries that DTI thought was not appropriate. DTI thought you could have lower priced countries in the basket, more Asian countries in the basket, and they never agreed. But what's very clear now is that ArcelorMittal is pricing above its own proposed basket. So even the basket it proposed is now pricing above that. We get into the whole Kumba story, et cetera, around the justifications for it. The third example I want to use, because the state's involved in a different way here. It's into forestry, and it's into Kumasi Lands, which is it's a state-owned enterprise, staff called company Kumasi Lands, which is the biggest producer of logs, not for paper, but logs particularly for sawn timber, which makes, so it's just structural timber, roof trusses, as well as for furniture. And we're investigating them in terms of their pricing and supply of logs to independent sawmills as opposed to their own sawmill. And independent mills closed down, and they're essentially not pricing on the same address properly and then finally conclude. This slide makes it a little bit out of place. It's about, when I say regional dynamics, I mean about the southern African region, not about South Africa. I think that it's important to understand from a competition point of view to have a regional view, not just a local view. I think from an industrial policy point of view, of course, this is not my main focus here. You know, we are going to grow as a region, not the country. We are going to grow if we grow the region. We are going to sell things to consumers in our neighboring countries. If their industries grow, they will be, their consumers who are there, citizens will be able to buy more products, they will be able to build better houses, etc. We will be able to sell to them. And so we have a very obviously mutually interrelated future. At a competition level, though, firms don't see borders the same way that we do. The firms and cartels operate across the region. So the cement cartel operated across the whole of Saku. So it was, they just allocated the whole of the Saku market. This is a business case by the fire shop in Saku. They've been doing it for very long, yeah. So you've got the final of the Swaziland, Namibia, South Africa, the province of South Africa, and they broke KwaZulu-Natal and Eastern Cape into two parts as well, and they allocated the region out. In terms of beer, work done by others, not us, suggests that multinationals, which S.P. Miller is one, kind of allocate countries across Africa to each other. And the poultry example that there is shows the other way around, where a new entrant into the South African market that really shook up the market and invested in creative jobs was actually a firm from Zimbabwe, which has then grown in Botswana. So the kind of cozy insiders, the two main players, were really shaken up by a firm that came in from the region. And in the other way, since the ending of arrangements in poultry, we've seen Astral, which is one of our big players, investing in Mozambique and investing in Zambia. And as the region grows, poultry demand grows. So if we want to talk about local supply of poultry, we should be thinking at a regional level, because the place where we're really going to grow a lot of the animal feed for the poultry is in Zambia. So Zambia is exporting about a third of its animal feed. So we might want to grow our poultry industry in terms of where is the source of the animal feed, given that we are a relatively water-scarce country, is actually going to be in the region. So growing regional value chains and investing in the region is very, very important to think about at that level rather than just narrowly in terms of South Africa. We're cooperating with other competition authorities in the region through the African Competition Forum, and I think obviously then we're looking at stronger value chains across countries. I think this is reflected in the IPAC. I just wanted to give some examples from the competition world. So from our perspective, very much from my perspective in the sense, as an economist in the Competition Commission, not speaking for the commissioners necessarily, I think where we come from, where we're going, I think where we've come from is we've seen industry insiders that have got long-established ways of working. So the industry insiders have essentially kept these ways of working, which tends to be very comfortable with high profit margins. And they weren't necessarily competing against each other, and therefore you don't have to invest. If you're a cement company and you've got a certain share of the local market, you don't have to even deliver your product on time. You don't have to worry too much because you own your customers. So think about the lack of dynamism that goes into developing capabilities in your business if you've got this little club which allocates the market out to protect their profit margins. No, it's like, you know, you fix all the games in the soccer league, then why do you have to worry about dealing with coach? You know, rivalry means you always get better at the capability. So rivalry is very, very important. But because you have these very large firms that have been used to doing this, they also cast themselves as custodians. And they often say, well, we're protecting the national interest. We're custodians of this. And this is, I think, a very important thing to think about, and I you know, give some examples. But if one looks at, and it's not that they aren't, because ultimately those are the main players, what you do. And I mean, if you look at the fuel referral that we referred last week, the non-confidential version of the referral is available. Essentially, there's a lot of discussions that happened around 2000-2001 among the fuel players, by this I mean the oil majors, about how they were going to continue to drive the agenda and how they were going to respond to BEE. The B wouldn't happen from new entrants coming in as traders or petrol station operators, but they were going to be cut in terms of getting shares in the majors. Because clearly if you've got a lot of margins all the way through the trading arm, you don't really want new players coming in as traders. last couple of years how if you go through some of the rural provinces, you actually see agricultural co-ops now setting up petrol stations, and there's traders coming in participating. But at the same time, there's big concerns about security of supply. And if you want refined products, you ask the major players are there, that's it. So it's not a black and white story, certainly, but it's something to be aware of because this has evolved over history. What we are worried about is you have low levels of investment. Why are we in the situation we are at the moment? In the article at the start today, or the business report about low levels of investment. But why do we have low levels of investment? Well, we certainly look at this as if the fuel companies, Ryanair, like an old oil stuff, they don't need to bother investing. It doesn't mean that we've got to resolve the problem, but they haven't been, a dynamic rivalrous context. People are trying to prove and look for opportunities, being really an old boy kind of operating. So what we need is a new type of settlement, a new type of understanding, because I think you can see these types of understandings as settlements, as kind of ways in which the industry says, this is how we operate, and they engage with government, and there's, there's an understanding about the way the industry operates. And it's not that you shouldn't have that understanding. Government sets rules, they set regulations. You do have to transport fuel around the country. You have to work out how to manage the storage facilities. You have to work out how to invest in pipelines. So you can't wish all of that away. But I think we do need to think about moving to a different place in terms of the way in which that operates, and focusing on long-term commitments and investments by big companies. And I think we need to, in that context, think about the coordination across the authorities, regulators, and governments, such as I illustrated in terms of mining rights. To use the existing levers better. And lastly, I think there's a question about government as shareholder, which I think is a concerning issue in terms of, for example, the forestry case, where government's the custodian of the forest. I think that's very important principle. If you make very long-term investments in looking at forests, parts of the forest in some parts of the country have been privatized, that's the Western Cape. Biggest forests under state ownership, and that's not unusual around the world, because you make your investments in the private sector tends to have short time horizon. But if you're the custodian of the forest, doesn't mean that you should grow the sawmill. Or doesn't mean that that's where you have smaller players that are out there, they're more nimble, they're more oriented towards customer service, etc. Or at least are you going to allow the state-owned entity to favor its own sawmill as opposed to the smaller independent sawmills, which is what our case is about. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roberts. David Burton, it's quite complimentary to the previous input that we had. So over to yourself now to raise the questions, make comments in this regard. Thank you. And I see by show of hands, I'll look here on this side first. Honourable Hill Lewis. That's right, there seems to be one. Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roberts. That was really interesting. I wanted to ask your view on kind of administered or legislated monopolies in state-owned entities, in SOEs, and what your view is on how that is, as you say, shutting down access to the economy. It's indisputable that the interest increases we're seeing wouldn't exist if there was a vibrant industry in independent power production. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that, sir.
Honourable Mabasa.
Thanks, Comrade Chair. Thanks for the input. My question is from the point of view of the Competition Commission. When you look at the products produced by industries, is it relevant to you whether they have been produced in labor-intensive methods or whether they have, because simplistically, some companies could simply import, so that the whole thing is spiking that way. And to the detriment of
Honourable Mabasa, Honourable James.
Just to pursue the steel question, I mean, how was it started? Where did it come from? But it clearly is rooted in the privatization of Eskom. So what was that deal? I think Eric Irwin was Minister of Trade. Please explain.
Thank you very much. No other questions or comments at this stage? No. I just, you know, you spoke about the work of the competition authorities and Dr. Roberts, and emphasize the need for a focus on priority areas, construction being one of them. You went on in terms of construction, cement, etc. But you also put here the issue, raised the issue of bid rigging. And I think that that is important. You know, you can sort out the cement, say, but now you need to still have the bid rigging. Could you please just expand upon the that one for us? And then the plastic products, etc. I mean, on the one hand, I understand Sasol, which we even commended, established a factory in China, as you know, and then we're not too sure now where the plastic's coming from or the polypropylene. But within our own country, are you suggesting, much like the iron ore, which was raised by the Honourable Khadebi previously, that we regard this as a strategic area and perhaps limit the percentage that can be exported? What are you proposing can be done here? Because for sure they'll be wanting to export something. That we could get a proposal for you in this regard. I'm reminded again that there was an agreement that there'd be a developmental steel price. But then we seem to have lost sight that there was an agreement. It was just that it couldn't be worked out what it was. They couldn't agree on the concept. The last point, the one we'd like to raise with you, on the poultry issue, you spoke about the establishment of factories here, production centres or breeding centres, etc. And yet, on the other hand, we are hearing more and more of the import of actual dead chickens, or what do you call them, like cold chickens or something, you know, which are brought in. Well, they are done. They're not bred here at all, but I understood that you were referring to the ones that were bred here earlier. Is that correct? I just want to clarify that particular one, because there would appear to be different factors involved. Next. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll do my best. I'll also make available other things that have been written on these topics for members as well to follow up. I think I'll go in the order that questions were asked. In terms of legislative monopolies, first of all, the Commission is not against monopolies, nor are they against regulation. You have things called natural monopolies. So where there's no point duplicating the infrastructure or the investments or the network, but if you have natural monopolies, then you should regulate them. So you should administer the prices. The second question then, in terms of, well, are you administering those prices? How well are you administering those prices? The answer is not, from our side, to say, well, don't administer them anymore, because then you just have a price monopoly. And so we're certainly not against regulation, and we're not against having administered prices. That would be a very naive view of industries that have got very big scale economies. And in fact, regulation could be an answer to some of the competition problems. If one decided, for example, that there were natural monopolies, or there was a monopoly in a change dominant firm, or to get a change in polypropylene, then you could regulate the price. And that might be because of the size of our economy, the history of the firm involved, and the distance that we are away from other markets. I'm not an expert on electricity, but it does seem to me that it's not necessarily the case that we would have lower prices, because we have really, and this is a little bit outside, I've done some work on this in a different capacity, but I mean, what happened was that we overinvested in the 1970s, and then we gave away the electricity at variable cost, and then we had to rebuild power stations just at the time when the whole world was rebuilding power stations, and it cost us a huge amount of money. So this is about not making investment decisions over time in advance. Now, you could also say that there are all the issues about municipalities and about the markups that are being added on by municipalities, etc. And that for me is a question about how well we are administering the privacy, but not to say that we should do away with the regulation. And so I think that that's what I would say there. In terms of Mr. Mbatha, Honourable Mbatha's question about labour-intensive methods, we prioritise, as part of our prioritisation process, we prioritise inputs to downstream industries which are labour-absorbing. We don't talk about ultra-labour-intensive, we talk about inputs which are coming from capital-intensive and often energy-intensive sectors, but those inputs are sold to customers where the customers are labour-absorbing firms. So we focus on a whole set of intermediate industrial products. And so polypropylene is a good example of that, as is steel. And so we focus it on that sense, not very much because our customers are local businesses, are local labor-intensive, labor-absorbing businesses. And we see them as customers. So customers are not your end consumers. They are our buyers who are subject to power of entrenched firms with market power. The steel question, I have to be careful here because I talk about this for a great length of time. So I think, yes, the privatization of the privatization of its core, there was trade liberalization, was a 30% duty was reduced to 5% and then 5% was reduced to zero. There was undoubtedly a need for reinvestment in its core, there was undoubtedly a need for improving the technology. You know, you have computer control of the whole process. So when you roll your steel, you need to control the process. To get the thickness or thinness of the steel sheet, to get the high quality finish, you might need, or say, a motor vehicle out of the panel. So there's definitely a whole need for investment and upgrading of capability, and the rationale for the privatization and the international participant was to bring a lot of that along. If you like, you can characterize it as a third step, not having followed through, which is that the dynamic investments are made, but you don't allow entrenched government position to extract continued supernormal profits. So you want to upgrade the technologies, but you want to continue for that firm to win the share based on the improved capability. What we're grappling now is the fact that we are a relatively remote economy in terms of other industrial economies. So there, we're a naturally protected market. You can take the tariffs down to zero, it still costs a lot if you're a customer to turn to the only competitor that you can see, which is in Korea. So if you want to buy a flat steel, not for long steel, not in the Cape Gate world, if you are buying flat steel, then the only real competitor you can turn for many of your products is a long way away, and it costs you a lot of money to bring it here. So you've got a naturally protected industry. Now you have this big margin that's sitting on the table, because you've got your import price and you've got very cheap. You've got your output price, rather, import parity prices, and you've got cheap inputs, cheap energy. We still have cheap energy when it goes to large firms, such as your BHP Billitons or your ArcelorMittal. You've got cheap iron ore. There's only one input that we don't have that's really cheap, which is coking coal, which we've discovered a lot of. And so you've got this nice big margin on the table. And another way of looking at the Kumba story is, well, who's going to get the margin? Because one of the parts of that juicy margin comes from the iron ore. And the deal that was done was to give that iron ore through to the steel firm, and now there's this deal fight over whether who should have that. Neither of the participants want the margin to disappear. Because the margin disappears and goes to the buyers of steel, the maker of the steel chairs or desks or whatever, or fridges or whatever it is, then it doesn't exist anymore. The Kumba report, commissioned by Kumba, I mean, one should look at critically, because it suggests that, you know, we don't have this potential to supply cheaper steel to the local market. That doesn't really surprise me. You should look at who wrote it. It's written by the same firm of consulting economists that acted for ArcelorMittal in the Harmony Gold steel case. So, well, I mean, that's the real world. I don't blame you for it. I just say that you should be critical when you read it. And then we have the developmental steel commitment, where there was no final agreement reached and essentially we're sitting there. But the question really is, well, what other tools does government have to use? Because the competition tools are not very sharp for monopoly conduct. It's a very long legal process and a lot of uncertainty about what the appropriate standards are under a competition regime. Competition appeal court sent the Harmony Gold case back to the tribunal, and then there was a settlement and it was never heard. there's a big debate about how you measure rate of return on capital investment. And to be very quick about it, essentially the fight is about whether you say that the firm should make a return to justify a new player coming in and build a new factory. So the mythical story or the ultimate argument, their economist said, you should allow us to make a profit rate that, as if we were building a new plant, to invest, to incentivize a new investment, as opposed to the case that was made, which is, well, nobody needs to build a new investment, we're still making 40% or 50% more than the whole country needs, and the whole South African region needs. This is a natural monopoly story, and it was built by the state. What you need to do is look at whether they're making a reasonable return over all of their cost inputs and the investments they need to make to upgrade and continue maintaining the plant. This is the same argument we're having with Sasol. So there's two states of the world. You need to allow the rate of return to allow brand new investments, huge capital investments, interest rates, or is it about price that allows a reasonable return on the old investments and to continue to maintain that factory on an ongoing basis? And so that kind of issue can go all the way, you know, to the Constitutional Court over many years. In terms of bid rigging, bid rigging is about large construction firms agreeing amongst themselves. It's not corrupt. You're not corrupting a public official. You're agreeing amongst yourselves who's going to get the tender. We uncovered this a couple of years ago now. We had a fast-track settlement process, which didn't seem very fast to remember, but fast-track in the sense that companies will come clean, submit all their information, and they have an all-in settlement under the competition regime. It doesn't protect them from damages claims from the buyer. So our penalty regime is not to recoup all of the money. Say there's a penalty that the parent to do in the future to clear the deck. Buyers need to go through and then look at their rights, which are separate rights. And I'm not the person in the commission dealing with this. I want a separate briefing on that. That I'm sure we would be able to do that. In terms of the capital of China, well, the capital actually walked away from the investment in China and rose over R1 billion. So, you know, I mean, this is a very good place for them to make. They've made investments elsewhere that haven't worked out, and they've made investments elsewhere, some of them which have worked out. But they're very, very, I would argue, certainly a very profitable company, and this is their natural market. What other tools could you use? Well, there's lots of tools that you can use, because essentially these companies have to be partners with the state. They need infrastructure. They need higher education. It has to be some kind of settlement, some kind of way of working about what is reasonable. When we looked at how other countries such as South Korea have dealt with it, this is not going to happen in this country. We have a different understanding about how this will operate, because we need to have a long-term investment. And I think that's where I'm going to, in terms of the final slide, which is really asking ourselves, what do we mean by inclusive shared growth? It doesn't mean that you may have smaller profit margins in the short term, but it does also mean in the longer term have a dynamic growing economy and a dynamic growing region. Because your customers must grow for you to grow. And so it's a long term versus short term. And what can you use in terms of levers? Because this is, of course, for one vote. I mean, I said, I don't blame them for it. This is what they say. If the money's on the table, they'll say, you know, they're profit seeking, they'll try and get a budget, and they'll want the longer term growth. What are the tools? Well, you've got mining rights in the context of a company like resource based companies. You have export duties. China has 10% export duties on unbeneficiated steel and aluminium. If you should come build a steel plant here, what you're not going to do is export the steel in a basic form, so they have an export duty. You could use those would be tools as other industrial policy tools. It's really about the decision to do that. You could regulate the price. The fuel is a regulated space, partially. Propylene gas is a byproduct of the fuel. You could regulate the propylene price. It's a gas that's a byproduct of a multi-product process. So it comes to the question about, you know, where is that boundary? It's not an either or. These tools are all there. What did happen, we had the windfall tax report in 2007, and the Treasury decided not to impose a windfall tax because and this is quite interesting to go back and look at, because Sasol has committed to make long-term investments to meet the needs of the country. we will just keep our listening and continue to try and argue with all our accounting experts, our economic experts, around what's a reasonable rate of return on the capital invested and the different price benchmarks and all the costs. And that's what the competition authorities will do. But there are many other tools out there to be used.
I think that that has really covered, unless you had your hand up to the article, Jay.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
If the Competition Commission was less of an instrument by way of some effective and targeted reform to the legislation that governs the work that you do, we would not be facing what seems to be an opportunity for individuals and companies to take issues directly to the Constitutional Court in the public interest around this particular question of the market. There's a 17th Amendment that we face that, if it goes through, would make it possible increasingly and it will flood the Constitutional Court competition issues. So I would imagine that you have a view about how you can do your work in a much more robust way as a Competition Commission, become less of a blunt instrument, as you described. I mean, David Lewis described very beautifully in one of your book about what the issues are.
Yes, please comment on this. What is the name of that commitment appeal that you mentioned? What's the old appeal that that whole thing they were making?
If you go back and look at the National Treasury response to the Windfall Tax Report from 2007-2008, I don't want to probably directly on this, but it's agreement came to long-term investments to increase production of fuel for the country. And it was specifically, I think, as my understanding is, and I think it's pretty explicitly, but certainly in press was afterwards, was around investment in additional refining capacity in terms of the Waterberg, which is, I mean, they were claiming, I think, that it's enabled by other problems. In terms of the and this is quite a big area about, so I'll try to be very short. I think we do three things, really. We do mergers, we look at cartels, and we look at dominant firms. I think I would argue that in mergers and cartels have been quite effective. I think what we're talking about particularly here is about dominant firms. And why is that the case? Well, our situation of our system of being separate commission and tribunals is very unusual. Very, very unusual. Most countries have one body that investigates and takes the decision, which is then appealable. The decision comes much faster. It's seen not as a judicial process, but more as a regulatory process. So it's much faster. The European Union decides they're going to take on Intel or Microsoft. They are, if you like, judge and jury, because they see it as part of economic regulation. Every time you change interest rates or tax rates, you affect businesses. So, I mean, government does it anyway. And then you have an appeal process. We've made the first stage of decision into that quasi-judicial adversarial process, which means it's very slow. It's not for mergers. Why? Because parties want the case to be heard, and they want the merger to happen. In cartels, we've incentivized people to come through and admit. So we've had this race to come through and admit. So we've, as a commission, abuses. Where you've got dominant firms, they want the investigation to go as slow as possible, and they will take on every single, you know, point that they can. And that's normal. So they can exploit the tribunal being separate from the commission, Competition Appeal Court, the SCA, etc. I want to look at that with another decision this week, which will again open up this. So if you wanted to prioritize the dealing with entrenched dominance, then other systems, which are a single authority, work much faster. Our particular provisions also make it difficult because we've separated out all the contraventions. And we've made it possible to go to the decision holding exercise. And I can send a paper I've written about this, other people have. So let me focus on that. But there's other countries have the regulators together with the competition authorities. Australia, the Netherlands, the regulator, the fuel regulator, the telecoms regulator, the post regulator, competition authorities, all one body. With different legal provisions. Now we're not saying we should go any particular route at all. We will focus on enforcing, feeling our powers in terms of the act to bring cases. This is obviously policy questions, but there's a menu of options, diversity out there that I think is not often realized.
Thank you very much.
very much, Dr. Roberts. If you could make available to the committee the article you made reference to, it would be helpful in this regard. So thank you very much for coming to us and sharing with us that information and those cases.